You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Welcome to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. That's right, folks, we are back, and we are going back to the movies this time. And we are going to see Ant-Man and Wasp, the third film from Marvel Studios this year. Can you believe it? Who would ever think three movies in a year from Marvel, comic book movies? It's just mind-boggling in a lot of ways. And it's going to be a lot of fun to talk all about it. And we've got a great crew to do it. But this is going to be a little bit of a special episode also, because we actually, you know, had a great loss in the comic industry, and adding to, you know, all the other losses we've had this year. But this is a true legend. And we decided to change up the format of the episode a little bit. So we're going to have two main topics. And we are going to be also talking about the passing of Steve Ditko. And we're going to start off the show with that tonight. And so I'm going to hand it over to Mike, and he's going to introduce our guest for this segment.
Yes, with us we have good time. We have with us.
Wow,
I know, right?
Hey, we're gonna have a good time talking about Steve Ditko.
Now we have with us artist Alan O.W. Barnes.
Hey,
welcome back to the station.
Glad to be here.
Yes, and we have the award-winning Bobby Nash returning.
Hi, guys.
And the multiple award-winning artist Mark Maddox is here.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on tonight. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to have you guys all with us. I wish it was under better circumstances. Before we get into Ditko, I do have to – there was another loss that we just discovered or found out about yesterday. And this is pertaining to comics indirectly as well. But in the local area, it's a tremendous loss. Found out yesterday that the Dragon Con comics and pop art director, Tom Trainer, passed away. And I know that is a big influence on me and my life and my career, actually. Bobby, I know you've known him probably longer than anybody here on the podcast.
Yeah, I've known him a long time, yeah.
And Mark, you probably interacted with him when you were at Dragon Con a couple years ago.
Possibly. I mean, I got to say... I don't know if I remember him or not. I definitely had heard the name before. I think there was a picture posted of him up, and I thought that I had recognized him. But you guys are much more heavily involved with Dragon Con than I am. So I'd have to say I don't have as much to add. I apologize.
No, it's okay. It's okay. And Alan, did you know him at all?
I met him once, but I really didn't know him.
Gotcha. He was a great proponent of the comics medium and art, and that his passion for that made him the perfect choice for the comics and pop art director of Dragon Con, which he did for, it was well over 8 years. Was it almost a decade, Bobby?
Somewhere around there. I forget the exact year he started running it, because I know he was involved. He worked with the track a little bit before he took over. But you know how it is. The Dragon Cons start to run together into one big Dragon Con.
Yes, absolutely.
I do remember that we were in the bottom of the Marriott in those early years. It was whatever year Domino Lady came out. Because I remember the year he took over. Because I remember where I was set up right outside the door, and I had the Domino Lady poster because it was coming out that year.
Like I said, about a decade probably. Mm-hmm. The Dragon Con comics area hadn't been really that well developed prior to that. It was kind of like a bunch of great artists and talent, comic talent, stuck in a side room corner.
Tiny room.
It barely, you know, way off the beaten path. And, since Tom took over, it just became a thing of beauty. And as I got more involved with my own projects, he was a great supporter of that. In fact, One of his after parties at Dragon Con served as the inspiration for the creating Tiki Zombie. So there really would be no Tiki Zombie without this man. He was a great guy to boot. I mean, every time I saw him, I can't say that there was a smile on his face, but certainly sometimes he could be a bit of curmudgeon, but there always seemed to be some love behind it. I know he was a great storyteller. I can remember after hanging out with him after Ace, which was a comic show that he pretty much put together himself, a spinoff of Dragon Con, just him telling story after story after story. And it was just a great time. I'm often jealous that I was not on that road trip with you, Bobby, to go to Chicago. Yes. That must have been an absolute hoot.
We had a blast because he kept... There was a joke that was made before we left. It was me, Tom, and Sean Taylor were trying. And someone had made a joke about, the GPS. That was in the first days where they talked. And... he kept doing, every time we would say something going on, he would just, out of nowhere, he would just throw up directions in one celebrity voice or another. And they would just kind of come out of nowhere, and they were quite hilarious. But we had a wonderful, wonderful trip that weekend. We went up for the Wizard Chicago comic show. Yeah, it was quite a good time. I had a blast.
Anyway, just a great guy and a big loss. Dragon Con this year is just going to be very strange without him there. I mean, his presence is going to be there in a lot of ways, but because his legacy of what he's done for Comic Track at Dragon Con will just live on forever. And, I'm just really sad to not hear his voice, to not see his posts daily. So very sad. So we'll talk a little bit more, give him another more of a deeper tribute probably on the next Dragon Con report. But I just had to mention that, for all his friends, family out there, it's a tremendous loss for us all. So, but to the subject at hand, yes, a few days prior to that, we had all heard surprising news that the great Steve Ditko had passed. And yeah, I think it took us all by surprise mainly because Ditko just hasn't been, like, he's not out there. So for any news to come out about Ditko would be a news story in and of itself, just because he was such a recluse. But this guy, if anybody's listening that doesn't know who Steve Ditko is, unfortunately, that's a little bit more understanding because, like I said, he shied away from the limelight. He was a recluse. But he is as important as almost anybody, especially in the early days of comics, and particularly Marvel Comics. Let's start, Mark, with you. I know that Ditko had to be an influence on you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oddly enough, I think the first thing I ever saw him of his was in the late 60s, was like a mini Ghosts of Dr. Graves cover for Charlton that my brother had picked up, and I thought the artwork was really beautiful. But what threw me off, my association with Spider-Man and the first issues of Spider-Man that I owned were John Romita Spider-Man. And that was a much more, I don't want to say Kirby-esque, but it was a much more of a big built-up superhero. Everybody was much larger than life and everything. So when I got a lot of the early Romita issues years later, well, not many years later, but about 1970 or so, our the school that I was going to had like a used book sale, and somebody brought in a stack of comics, and I was quite shocked to see what early Spider-Man looked like. It was this wiry, skinny kid bouncing around, almost comedic in its intent, at the same time dramatic. And all the characters in there were drawn the same way. And then I realized, hey, this is the same guy that I've also seen doing the Marvel, not the main story Monster Comics, but when Jack Kirby would do some of these monster stories that they were reprinting them in the in the late 60s and early 70s, they would put Steve Ditko stories in there too, which were very different from Kirby, but just as wonderful. These amazing stories. And sometimes they even work together, you know, drawing and inking and stuff like that. So I saw this Spider-Man comic, and it took me a little bit to get used to it, you know, playing catch up. But over the years, it's become to me the ultimate version of Spider-Man, which really everybody eventually runs back to. You know, whatever artist it is, they go back to the wiry, skinny looking arachnid-esque sort of Spider-Man. And Ditko is the king of that. Plus, and I also dearly, dearly loved his Doctor Strange stories. I saw those in reprints in, I don't know, it was like something like Marvel Collector's Item Classics or Marvel Tales, one of those that redid them. And I loved his version of Doctor Strange. I think that both of those characters, he rules them. He owns them. They're his.
Oh, I agree completely with that. His Spider-Man, you know, set the path correctly. If you think about it, you know, the first 25 issues until, you know, they started at, you know, going and he left the series, Spider-Man was a little kid. Even after he graduated high school, he still was a kid, a skinny little nothing. And you could see why he got picked on and such. And Ditko carried it off perfectly, the feel. And the bad guys he came up with, he came up with Doc Ock. He came up with the Vulture. He came up with, you know, Green Goblin. All those characters, you know, J. Jonah Jameson, Parker, Aunt May, all that. That was all Steve. You know, he laid this groundwork for it. And it was so amazing. And like Mark said, with Doctor Strange, everything, the universe he created out of it. And I actually felt like a lot of the movie that we were watching last year, it was just felt like that was, I was seeing, you know, Ditko's work come to life, literally.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, he's definitely created that type of weirdness that we see whenever Doctor Strange goes to the astral plane or whatever. And the fact that we were able to get that translated into movies, because Ditko had a very interesting way of looking at these supernatural type occurrences, and did them in a way that was unlike anything I had ever seen before. And he was just a talented guy. And he was the guy I knew. I liked his Spider-Man before I knew who it was that drew them. My first Spider-Man was when my first, you know, introduction to the Spider-Man comics was when Keith Pollard was drawing them. But I remember once I started liking those, we found those digests that would paperbacks that would collect like six or so issues. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting those, and it was I had like the first two or three. And so it was like starting with Amazing Fantasy 15, and you go up, and it was like, it was more, even though, like you said, it was a bit cartoony in the faces, there was just something about it that really jumped out at me as very dynamic in the way Spider-Man, the way he jumped around and the way his feet moved and his hands moved. He looked a little almost inhuman at times. It was a Ditko trait that really amped up the spiderness of Peter, where he doesn't look just like a guy leaping through. He's moving in a way that works. And then of course he did that with Doctor Strange and other characters as well, with hand gestures and things of that nature.
It's interesting too, because like for me, Ditko, I didn't like, you and I were talking at the con yesterday, Bobby, about it a little bit. And I fully admit it. I didn't like his work at first. I thought it was too cartoony. Mm-hmm. And after seeing, you know, at the time growing up as a teenager, you know, and young teen, seeing, you know, Byrne and Perez and Neil Adams, you know, seeing these ultra realistic type characters, and then finding the, like or Son of Origins or Origins of Marvel Comics or the digests that they came out with, and seeing, you know, the Ditko Spider-Man and then falling in love right away with Doctor Strange. Yeah. It was just blowing away. And then the work he did later is just awesome.
Yeah. I think we all kind of do that. It's kind of like when you talk about, you know, it also translates to like when you talk James Bond or Doctor Who, whoever you're, whatever it was when you first found it, you know, and I think all of us, probably our first introduction to Spider-Man was not Ditko.
Yeah.
So when we first saw Ditko work, it was like, this is a little odd. But then once you get into it, you realize there is some magic there.
Yeah. Actually, for me, I think, you know, I was trying to remember that and why that I wasn't so alarmed by, because I don't remember being like, oh, Ditko's work is not really doing anything for me on Spider-Man, because I think it's because around the time that I was reading Spider-Man, I was also watching the 60s cartoon, mm-hmm. which is like Ditko come to life. I mean, like that, a lot of that artwork. And so when I read the old stories, I was used to that artwork already. So like that was just fine with me, because that cartoon was really, really awesome. I couldn't get enough of it. So I think I was very comfortable with Ditko's artwork in the books, because it just seemed like it was already established that that's what, you know, that's what Spider-Man, like a lot of the poses that they used over and over and over for him swinging around were mm-hmm. just basically cutouts of, you know, his covers and his strips put to life, you know? So I think so. Alan, what about you? When would you, do you remember your first introduction to Ditko?
Yeah. And like what you guys are all saying, when I first encountered Ditko, I really didn't give it much thought, to be honest with you. It was in my early teens, and they had started reprinting the early Spider-Mans in something or another. I don't remember what it was, but it was a monthly.
Marvel Tales.
Marvel
Tales, yes.
And that was actually the first time I saw Ditko's work. And like all of you are saying, you know, I was already sort of on the Perez, Byrne, Simonson bandwagon and didn't really know what to think of it, but I remember reading those stories and loving them. And it wasn't until years later that I understood that the reason I loved them was because of what a masterful storyteller Ditko was. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually, I'll get a little snobby on you here for a second and tell you that I included a bit of information about Ditko in my my graduate thesis. Because I wrote my graduate thesis on eye leading, and I think that that's actually one of the two big, huge things that I learned from Ditko. He would do these just amazing panel sequences where it was obvious that Spider-Man was going to end up where he ended up in the next panel because of the physical motion he was swinging, you know? So one panel would be Spider-Man about to leap into the next panel. The next panel would be Spider-Man doing a somersault into the panel to the bottom left, you know, that sort of thing. And it really, I think it really aided that, among, you know, thousands of other things, were what really helped you read those stories effortlessly. And I think that that's something that's missing in some of the more modern storytellers. You know, the other thing that Ditko did that absolutely blew me away, going back to the Doctor Strange conversation for just a second, is he came up with a symbolic language for magic. And I think that that's a lot of how you're able to, you know, I kind of think that some of the incantation stuff that Stan Lee came up with is a little hokey. But I think we buy it all the time because of the just masterful symbology drawn around it, you know?
Mm-hmm. His creation of those alternate worlds were so wild. I think that you could almost say that he was taking a chance. I think he knew himself. I think he knew like other great artists that knew how to, like Eisner, and he knew what was in his head. He knew that it would work. But when you look at it on paper and you see the final, you know, Doctor Strange goes into this other dimension and all this weird things are floating around and there's weird bridges that just go all over the place. You're like, boy, I'll tell you what, if Ditko hadn't have done this, we would have missed something really great. We would have really missed out on something. To me, it's a tie between which one's more incredible, Spider-Man or Doctor Strange. I think it's almost neck and neck. I know that Spider-Man's the more famous character and everything like that, but it amazes me all the brand new things that came out of Doctor Strange. And to the point where when we all went to the film, everybody's standing in line saying, hey, man, this better look like Ditko. You know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It was just like, if it don't have Ditko in it, it ain't Doctor Strange. And they did. They had Ditko-esque moments in it that you know, made everybody happy.
Do you think Steve ever got to see it? Do you think Steve ever went to go see it and found out that they used so much of his material?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you can't ask the man. I mean, I don't think you could have asked him a year ago whether he saw it, or did they invite him, or, you know, there's documentaries on people trying to find him and talk to him, you know.
Well, he was not hard to find. I mean, he still went to his office every day.
Right.
It was getting him to answer the door.
Right. Well, yeah, which is the same thing. It might as well be 1,000 miles. You know, the thing is that what got me thinking about Steve Ditko, even before I realized it was weird, because I was probably thinking about him even the day he died, was the fact that Harlan Ellison had passed away. And I remember one of the favorite things, and I got my butt chewed out by Harlan Ellison. I wear it as a badge of honor, because, you know, usually you do. But one of the things I really loved that Harlan Ellison did was the Masters of the Comic Book art video, where he picked his, I think it was like somewhere between 8 and 10 of the best. He had Kirby and Wrightson and Will Eisner and Mobius and stuff, but he also had Ditko in there. And I was thinking about that video and thinking, you know, I haven't heard from Ditko, but one of the things I always thought was that he would die and nobody would find him for days. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And that's the thing when you live like that. And I didn't even have an opportunity to be sad about it, because I always was ahead of the curve on that. I always knew that's the way it was going to be. And I think he was in the house for, I don't know how many days, part of a week, a whole week. I don't know what it was, but that was the way he lived. He didn't, you know, he expressed it through his work. I don't know if anybody ever saw that manifesto kind of thing he wrote about superheroes. I have been at times in deep agreement with that manifesto, where he said, you know, superheroes are here to teach morals. And he didn't really agree with the gray area superheroes. He thought that you were missing the point. But he had his firm beliefs, I guess, and keeping out of people's way was one of them.
Yeah. Well, and also, too, I mean, we've talked a lot about Spider-Man and Doctor Strange here, which admittedly are probably his two biggest, the creations that he was involved with.
Sure.
But if we look at all the characters that have come and gone that Ditko was involved with, he didn't just keep cloning those two characters over and over. He had some really unique ideas. I mean, just in looking at the design work of characters like the Creeper or the Question or Shade the Changing Man, which are very interesting looking designs.
Yeah.
You know, not giving a face to the Question, or, you know, making the Creeper this loony guy with this big lion mane, or, I mean, we could go on any number of things, but, you know, there was a design quality to Ditko that just, it was uniquely Ditko.
Yeah. Yeah.
What the symbology behind the lack of face was, because he seemed to come back to that a lot. You know, Spider-Man was probably the first character that didn't have any amount of his face showing.
I got the impression that was that part of that was that he was a child under there. So any sort of any exposure of the face would have shown that you're dealing with like a high school kid. And so the face was, he felt that the face was covered. But I know what you mean. I agree with that. I think there's something very disturbing about a missing face. It's been used in science fiction and stuff. They did it on Star Trek before. I mean, you've got this, the, you know, when your personage is missing, right. It can be very disturbing. But Ditko was, I mean, and I mean this with complete love, Ditko was weird. I mean, he did weird stuff.
It's true.
And that was what was so cool about him. Now, the one I wanted to read and never got a chance, I'll ask you guys, has anybody, the one that seemed to fascinate me from what I've heard about the description is Mr. A. Does anybody know anything about that? Could somebody describe that a little bit to me? I'm curious about it.
I just know the write-ups about it and that it was a very different kind of protagonist hero character. And it sort of, he implemented it and used some of his own, I think, personal philosophy in it. Mm-hmm. But yeah. To be honest, I really don't know much more than that.
So actually just a minute ago when someone was, I think it was you, Mark, saying something about he believed that the manifesto, when he was talking about he thought that comic book heroes were supposed to teach morals. I think Mr. A was his example of that. And I got to tell you, if that's his example, it's kind of funny because he would literally have this character like beat people up and then proselytize to them about objectivism, you know. and a lot of times the people that he was beating up weren't actually doing things that we would normally think of as doing anything, you know, wrong enough for the amount of beating they would receive.
You know? Man, so, I know I'm going to go out and buy it.
But yeah, Mr. A is unquestionably like a fascinating book just to try to wrap your head around.
Well, I got the impression there was a bit of Ayn Rand in there, is that there's a bit of that black and white sort of thing, almost to a degree, which really for us now sounds like a guy, you know, with his walking stick yelling at kids to get off his lawn.
What I was talking about with objectivism. That's what the Ayn Rand quote unquote philosophy is called. I say quote unquote because like every philosophy student I've ever known sort of laughs at the idea that that's called a philosophy, but you know, it is still really, really popular, and especially amongst our current Republican brethren, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of the other things I have to mention too, because I just I forget about this, and then something reminds me, and then unfortunately Ditko's passing reminded me of this, is that when I was younger, the earliest, when people ask me what my first comic is, it's really difficult for me to remember that far back as far as what my first actual comic was. But I do remember that quite often I would have about 10 comics that I would sort of carry with me wherever I went. A couple of them were Richie Rich comics, some Batman and Spider-Man were thrown in there. But there was one in particular. It was Space War number 30, which was from Charleston Comics. And it was an anthology. It was actually, I didn't know it at the time, but it was actually reprints of this Out of This World book that had been done previously. Mm-hmm. But it's got this gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous and haunting Steve Ditko science fiction cover with these aliens shooting this massive gun at the Earth and part of the Earth exploding. And it's got a few Ditko stories in it. I don't know much of his superhero work outside of, I mean, I'm aware of it, but I didn't really get into his superhero work outside of Spider-Man very much. But I do remember I carried that book with me, all over the place. I loved the image on the cover. It just was like really gorgeously rendered. And I don't remember the specifics of it now. I'm going to dig it out. I meant to do it this weekend and just reread it because it's been so long. But I do remember the Ditko stories are very strange. Like they're like, you know, it was perfect for that sort of, you know, science fiction medium. But even you expect weird, strange stories, but even like his stories take them up even another notch. Like they're odder than the weird, strange stories. Right.
Yeah. Right.
Huh. And he was also, in addition to the, and he did a lot of those, a lot of science fiction stories and a lot of monster stories too. I mean, did he, am I mistaken? Did he, I don't know if he created him, but didn't he like draw like the first like Groot?
No, that was Kirby. That was Kirby, but he did. I mean, it was really, those two guys were the powerhouse between, behind their most popular of the monster slash science fiction stories. It, I mean, when I picked up a comic book, and granted, mine was a reprint, but when you picked it up and it had, you know, a Kirby and a Ditko story in there, man, you were set, you know, And I think the thing is, his stuff was so different from Kirby, and yet they complemented each other so well. And like, even in times, like there's one called, you know, I kind of named my tortoises kind of after this, is Zootac, the creature that shouldn't exist. and I've got my tortoises, Krotok and Tortok, which I call the tortoises that just shouldn't exist because they're just so damn big now. But They actually would, you know, Kirby drew it, but Ditko inked it, and the combination of the two of them together is just magnificent.
Yeah,
and then also too, and I got to get this little bit in here, is Ditko working at first? I think at first a little bit as an inker on one of them, and then getting the whole story of the Hulk, like one of those really early Hulks.
Yeah, he did like a couple of the early Hulks. Yeah, I know there's one where he did like with the Metal Master on the cover, where he's being like trapped in a cage.
And it's wonderful stuff. His version of the Hulk is such a great interpretation. But also before that, I think he inked, I think it was, I know at least the cover is Hulk versus the Toad Man, the second issue. And I don't know if the interior's inked by Ditko. I know, but the cover's a Kirby Ditko combo. And it's just absolutely fantastic the way those two looked good together. But then he got his own, he got to do the Hulk himself. And I wish there was all volumes of that stuff. Unfortunately, there isn't.
Yeah. And Ditko, tell me, when we're talking about characters, I mean, and not just characters, but things that he created, things that are still integral to the Marvel and DC universes today. You know, you're talking Kirby here too, you know, whereas Kirby, you know, is the guy that's usually thought of for creating all these big cosmic things like Galactus and the Silver Surfer. You know, Ditko is the guy that gave us Eternity, you know, this big guy with like eternity inside his body.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you know, these are things that they complement each other when they've been used together, those characters, you know.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And yeah.
And it was pretty awesome because he's drawn almost every character in the original Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And so it's pretty awesome to think about. And, you know, the fun thing, like first time I was reading Watchmen, I was already at that point a fan of his work when he was doing The Question and doing Captain Atom and doing Blue Beetle, thinking about, oh, wouldn't have this been cool if they would have used Ditko's art?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have, I know we mentioned, Spider-Man, obviously, and Doctor Strange being adapted into films. You know, it's kind of sad that he won't see, you know, Hawk and Dove are coming to the Titans, or Squirrel Girl is coming to the what's the show? New Warriors. You know, that these characters that he created that still haven't, you know, like you said, where he's a recluse, so we didn't know if he would have seen them anyway.
I was going to say, like, you say it's a shame he wouldn't see it. I'm like, I don't know if he really cared. Like, I just.
Well, I don't know. Is he like Alan Moore in that respect? Is Alan Moore like, you know, I don't care what they're doing with my
stuff? I don't know. I've never heard of anything of him putting them down.
Right.
But he just didn't want to be, he just didn't care enough to be involved. I know he kind of washed his hands of corporate comics after a while.
Yeah.
I know, you know, he had some problems with. Yeah, you know, he didn't feel like he was treated right at Marvel and DC sometimes. I mean, things like that happen, and you know, and I don't want this to be about that. But I mean, I know, but this is a guy that at 90 years old, he was still drawing comics. He was still creating comics.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was still doing what he loved doing on the last day of his life, I find that immensely satisfying. And I hope that on the day that happens when I shuffle off this mortal coil here, that I'm doing it sitting at my laptop going, damn it, I got deadlines.
Yeah, yeah. I feel the same way. Sprawled across my art table.
Yeah. Well, and last week, you know, when we did our tribute to Harlan Ellison, Mike and I were lamenting the fact that he was, you know, really kind of the last of the old guard as far mm-hmm. as the great science fiction literature giants of the certainly the early, you know, or last century, really.
Yeah.
And I think with Ditko's passing, you get a sense of that, too. Now, of course, it's kind of still overshadowed because Stan Lee's still with us, thank God. But you know, everybody around Stan that he worked with is gone pretty much, you mm-hmm. know, like with very few exceptions. And so, yeah, we are seeing the this sort of passing, not passing of the torch so much, but it's just kind of sad to know that these giants are, you know, and we've lost another giant. You know, and
yeah,
and mm-hmm. You know, there's not too many of them left. I don't think.
Yeah,
I think when we were talking the other night, Bobby, I think it's Stan and Larry Lieber, right? Like,
yeah, well, and Alan Bellman's still around, but there's not many. True. Yeah, there's not many.
There's been yeah. there. I've done enough shows with you guys to say I think we're closing the door on the original group, and we did Q-Bert. Yeah. And we did, you know, we've even done young people that we shouldn't have been doing. We did Bernie right. Wrightson. We shouldn't have been doing Bernie Wrightson.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, the ones that were considered the kids who came in, the young kids that came in are getting on up there, like your Roy Thomas and your John Romita. These guys have,
yeah.
you know, they were the kids, but I mean,
yeah, Kaluta is getting up there. I don't think mm-hmm. he travels too far to conventions now. And I remember seeing him and saying, well, that's a kid there when you see mm-hmm. photographs of him, not anymore.
Well, the fact that, you know, when I first looked up Ditko's Wikipedia page, and one of the first things it says is that he studied under Jerry Robinson. I was like, wow, that's like.
Yeah, and Mort Meskin.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize that Kirby and Simon Studios were, I guess, what they were the first people to hire him, and he worked with Meskin at first, which you know, is, I mean, that's great. I mean, wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall, you know, or a spider and see that, you know.
But obviously Ditko didn't, you know, he wasn't around for the, I don't think you can say the golden age. I mean, he was a little bit, but I mean, he really made a name for himself in the with Spider-Man, right? And so in that era, so which is a kind of a past the golden age, and yet
yeah, but he started still, like in 50. I can't remember there was
right,
a horror
50s,
comic,
right?
But it was still that phasing out of the definitely not superheroes, but during that whole crime horror period, he kind of stuck his toe in the door.
Right, right.
At that point, right.
Yeah, yeah. He starts there, and then he helps pave the way along with Kirby and yeah. Simon and others to the like the new age. And you know, for look, I am still a huge comics fan and to this day, but sometimes I look at these greats. Sort of like last week when we looked at with the science fiction sort of, you know, passing of Harlan Ellison with the science fiction literature and everything. It's like there doesn't seem to be that many influences, giant influences, risk takers, definers of new ways of telling stories as there was like, you know, 50, 60 years ago.
Right. Well, right. And these guys were, they were inventing superhero storytelling because really
right.
this Marvel style of telling these type of stories did not exist before Ditko and Kirby and right. Stan Lee and these guys were creating the Marvel Universe. So they were really, you're right, they were taking a risk because had the public not liked what they did, imagine what comics might what might have happened to comics had this not worked?
Well, I mean, I think it's obvious that some of the things that they did, public liked, and some of them they didn't. So, but really, I mean, to this day, when you pick up a Marvel or DC book, you know, whether it's Spider-Man, who just celebrated his 800th issue, mm-hmm. or you know, or Watchmen, which is using, you know, characters that are very similar or, you know, an indirect Ditko characters, because you've got the new Watchmen book. You know, they are still standing. You know, they're being carried by the work that these guys started. They're just working underneath their shadow still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, every time I see Spider-Man on the screen, you know, especially like that first. The first couple of who was the one who directed Raimi. the first two?
Raimi.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that one, Raimi, and you see him now. You see the fight at the airport, you know, in the one Captain America film and all that stuff. And it's Ditko Spider-Man. I mean, we can say, oh well, it's Tom McFarlane Spider-Man. It's like, well, Tom McFarlane Spider-Man is got Tom McFarlane style to it. But it's back to that old wiry, skinny, weird shaped, you know, one arms, you know, he's got his feet are almost above his head while his arms going in between his legs and firing one thing a web and the other one's back behind him. And it's like, can people actually contort like that? Well, Spider-Man can. Right. And you get that in those films. You know, in bucket loads. So, you know, that's why I said, I think to me, it brings it full circle with me that it's just his character. It's visually, there's no other place to go. You will eventually come back to Ditko.
Well, speaking of Ditko homages in film, I think we probably have to mention Spider-Man 33, where, you know, Spider-Man's got the giant, thing on him and he has to get out from under it, and they finally did it in the last movie. I'm not sure I liked how they did it in the last movie because it didn't have some of the same emotional resonance as it did in the comic, but I was really happy to see that they finally did it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They, I agree. I thought that when I was watching that scene, I'm like, this is a scene that I've wanted to see, but it was not as powerful as it was in the comics.
Right.
You're talking about the one with Michael Keaton,
I love that movie, by the way.
Yeah, but great moments.
But that scene where he has to, you know, man up or spider up, I just thought they kind of took the wind out of it a little bit. Because it is one of the most powerful scenes, I think, in all of comics, certainly in Spider-Man history.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's the page that when they ever do any kind of retrospective or whatever, they have to go back to those two pages.
Right.
And you know, when you're talking about risk taking too, that's a fairly risk taking because they're not action heavy pages. There's several pages of him just laying there going, I've got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, but yeah. It's the between the writing and the art and the way it all works together, you're riveted to this, this conflict that's all inside of him. And then you get the big payoff when he finally, you know, heaves that machinery off of him. And there's a reason it's one of Spidey's best moments, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So we have to wind down this discussion, unfortunately. But I do want to leave the viewers with, or our listeners rather, with, some suggestions that if they are not familiar, or even if they are familiar with Ditko's work, if there's something in particular that you can recommend that they check out in like for its own, you know, Ditko uniqueness. Mark, we'll start with you. Is there something in particular that you think people should check out?
I know that they've got all these, big hardback books now. The omnibus. I've got the Amazing Fantasy one with, and I was kind of surprised. I bought it, picked it up at Dr. No's, and I thought, well, this is going to be, even though it's got a Ditko cover, it's mostly going to be Kirby. It was mostly Ditko. That's what kind of surprised me, or a large portion of it was. Amazing Fantasy. I would say pick that one up. It's got Tim Boomba on the cover. And it's got a lot of those great Ditko stories. It's pre-superhero, but I always found them to be just incredibly charming.
Awesome. Awesome. Alan, what about you?
Well, I mean, obviously Spider-Man 33. But in addition to that, you know, some stuff that I saw from Ditko that really made a big impression on me when I was really first discovering him. And I wish I could remember numbers. I'm so sorry I don't. But his creepy and eerie work was really awesome. He did these you know, really short stories in that. And if you just want to dip your toe in and see what Ditko's about, I think those are a great place to start.
Awesome. Bobby?
If you're a Spider-Man fan, Marvel just recently released one of their Epic collections, which are those big, thick paperbacks that cover like 20 issues. They just released one called Great Power, the Stan Lee and Steve Ditko years. It starts with Amazing Fantasy 15, goes up through Amazing Spider-Man 17 and the first annual. It's got a great Ditko cover on it with him fighting his various enemies as the Sinister Six. So if you're Spider-Man, that's an awesome, that's prime Ditko Spider-Man. But I also, one character we haven't mentioned yet, and you can probably find collections, I'm assuming, was his Blue Beetle work at Charleston, and then the character later moved to DC. Those are a lot of fun. I don't know if they're collected, but surely they have to be somewhere.
I think you can find those.
Yeah, because that's good stuff too. And if you are a Spider-Man fan, you'll probably enjoy Blue Beetle. There are some similarities.
Oh, yeah.
Mike?
Oof, that's tough, because I'm going to have to say, for me, it's going to be the Marvel Essentials book one of both Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. Mm-hmm. That lays the groundwork for a lot of the MCU that you get to see both in the movies and so much in the comics. It's just amazing stuff. And seeing the worlds he created with Stan in these, it's just really amazing. And I think we, you know, missed, you know, being cursed, and I'm not, it's really being cursed by having Jack Kirby draw Spider-Man, because at first that's what it was supposed to be.
And let me just say too, that art in black and white, oh, so good.
It is awesome. You can see all the details. It is truly amazing. And the emotion he captures in all those stories, both the Spider-Man and the Doctor Strange. It's just, it's great.
Awesome. I'm going to recommend, and I don't have this yet, but it's something that I definitely want to pick up. It's one of the things that's, yes, on my radar. It is called The Art of Ditko. It was put out by IDW about 10 years ago. It's edited by Craig Yeoh. And if you know anything about Golden Age comics, you know that Craig is the man when it comes to collecting this stuff and putting together great collections. And it includes a lot of, like his, I don't want to say independent work, but at the time it's like his stuff from The Many Ghosts of Dr. Graves, Ghostly Tales, Out of This World, the science fiction stuff that I mentioned, Space Adventures, Strange Suspense Stories, Tales of the Mysterious Traveler, This Magazine is Haunted, all these stories, these crazy, crazy science fiction and horror stories that he put together. And it's a great, there's an introduction even by Stan Lee in it. So it's quite the collection, and I definitely want to add it to mine. So, well, thank you all for joining us. It's been very good to talk about this with you guys. I appreciate it. Since you probably aren't going to stick around for the movie review and the shout outs, quickly tell us where we can find you, Mark.
I am right now, finally got back from conventions. You can always check me out on Facebook, the Mark Maddox in Tallahassee, doing lots of work, lots of jobs. I've got a Blu-ray gig that's starting to happen, which I'm pretty excited about, but I can't go into specifics because it hasn't been announced by the company yet. But I'm excited about that. And just, you know, hey, you know, friend me on Facebook if you like the kind of work I do and you like old horror films and things like that and science fiction. Just Facebook friend me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Alan?
Yeah. AlanOWBarnes.com. There are links to all of my social from there. It's A-L-A-N. My two middle initials, O-W. Barnes like Barnes & Noble. And let's see. I've been drawing this comic called Marrow Man for the last almost 2 years now, and it's you can't buy it. You have to be in the hospital getting a bone marrow transfer in order to donation. I mean, in order to see an issue of it. But I do that for a company called the Epic Battle Campaign, which is in conjunction with Be the Match, which is the National Bone Marrow Registry. And then I've got a couple books coming out next year that I'm excited about, and I hope you'll have me back on to talk about them when it's time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You are welcome back anytime, sir.
Thank you, thank you.
Anytime? And, really?
Well, okay, you know, we'll talk. Within reason. Exactly. Bobby, what about you?
You can find me at bobbynash.com. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those places. Yeah, please friend me, and you know, I have books coming out later this year. You can find all that information on my website.
Awesome. And yes, and of course Mike and I will be back after the break to talk all about Ant-Man and Wasp.
Yes, but before we get out of here, let's real quickly thank some of our patrons for donating to us. You know, you can become a patron also and help support the ESO Network right up on esonetwork.com. Right at the link right at the top, and you could do it for as little as $1 a month and help support the station. And speaking of dollar people, let us thank Jacob Haller and also Wayne Garmill and also Bob Matthews. Thank you guys so much for being supporters of the ESO Network. And as we always like to say, we could not do this without you. All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with our review of Ant-Man and Wasp.
Welcome to the Soul Forge, a place of silent mystery, quiet contemplation, and outright mayhem. Join your host, Sean Vanderloo, as he guides you through the adventures of living. Together, we'll talk about life and love, sex and dating, joy and heartache, memories and loss, and so much more. Don't worry, it's not nearly as pretentious as it sounds. Get ready for life, the universe, and everything on the Soul Forge.
SoulForgePodcast.com.
So, how long have you been Ant-Man again?
Not long. It just sort of happened.
I wish I could fight bad guys like you.
I seem to mess it up almost every time.
Maybe you just need someone watching your back. Hi. Like a partner.
Dr. Pym, I actually heard what happened to you. You opened up the quantum realm. That's when these crazy creepy ghosts who like walks through walls and stuff. Stole your tech. And now she wants to take over the world or whatever.
Who would have believed that in your hour of need, you would turn to us?
Not me.
Because we robbed you. Do you remember? That's us.
The only chance you got is both of you.
Ant-Man and the Wasp teaming up.
Follow my lead.
She seems more intense.
No. You go low, I'll go high.
I have wings. Why would I go low?
We're gonna die. I don't wanna die. We didn't die!
Hey, what'd I miss?
We were just tiny!
I was partners with Hank on a project called Goliath.
How big did you get?
My record, 21 feet. You?
65 feet.
65.
If you two are finished comparing sizes...
65.
Welcome back, everyone. And although the weekend was full of some sad news, as we've just talked about, there was some light, some bright spots. I certainly had a lot of fun seeing Ant-Man and Wasp, and hopefully I'm going to have a lot of fun talking all about it with Mike. And of course, our movie crew, that is Ashley, has returned.
Hello. How's it going?
And Alex Autry is back.
I'm like a bad penny. I just keep turning up.
Well, sure. So, okay. So the expectation on this one, I don't even know what we can say was the expectation, but because certainly under the wake of Infinity War, the next Marvel movie is kind of going to be underplayed no matter what, right? So I don't know exactly what kind of expectations were put on this movie, but I will tell you that when I saw it on Sunday morning, the theater was not even half full. It was very empty. How well did it do box office wise?
You know, I'm a little bit still bitter concerning the reaction and overall reporting of Solo, which did $84 million in its opening weekend and was therefore considered a box office disaster, and everybody from Star Wars should be fired. Ant-Man and the Wasp did $75 million.
Okay.
And that's just, so, is that just in the States or?
That is domestic. I honestly have not seen anything regarding what its full amount is. But honestly, for a movie that is a lower level, I don't even want to call it a B grade, because that would be an ant pun. But it's a lower tier hero film. Almost to the point where, honestly, if Paul Rudd wasn't involved, I could see this almost being a Netflix level character. I'm not saying that.
It's hard to say that though with a movie that has, you know, Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer in it and Lawrence Fishburne. You know,
but the level of character,
yes, no, I get
that it is, would be that same sort of, not that the level of movie and not the level of acting was like that. That would be an insult to the people who worked on this film, because it's actually a really good movie. But yeah, only $75 million. It puts it on par, really, with past Marvel solo films. Like Captain America: Civil War. I think that one did $100 million, but Winter Soldier, I believe, did around the $70 million mark, and a couple of others like that. Thor, the Thor movies, all hit around the $70 million, $80 million mark.
According to the Wikipedia page, it has so far grossed $161 million worldwide.
It's doing really, really well overseas.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. By the way,
the Wikipedia page for the guy who was Hawkeye, his name
Alan Alda.
No, Jeremy Renner. Oh. Jeremy Renner's Wikipedia page used to say that he was a Velociraptor. So, and it was verified, which I think is wonderful. But
by Jeremy Renner.
It's okay. So $160 million worldwide for a movie like this is actually really solid.
Yeah,
that's a great deal. But again, it's riding a 20-year or a 10-year pacing for Marvel.
Sure. It's all connected too. I mean, no matter what Marvel puts out next, I mean, people are going to gross at least, you know, somewhere around $100 million worldwide, right? In the first week.
The first week, yeah, that's safe to say.
Yeah.
That's safe to say because it's going to pull in about $70 million minimum in the US.
Right. So in addition to box office wise, and like I said, it's under the umbrella, you know, the after effect of of what Thanos's actions of Infinity War. In addition to that, it in and of itself, it's got a little bit of higher expectation. The first movie, because of the turmoil, quote unquote, turmoil making the movie, a lot of people, and the unknown fact of, like, really, Ant-Man, they're making a movie about Ant-Man. They're really digging to the bottom of the barrel. That kind of thing, it took a lot of people by surprise. Because I remember when we did our summer movie review, there were not a lot of great, like, this was going to be Marvel's quote unquote big mistake. And it wasn't. They did really well. So now here's a sequel. So you can't take us by surprise anymore. Now there's expectations on this movie. So I'm wondering, Ashley, what do you think that lived up to those expectations? or what did you think about it overall?
Yeah, well, the first Ant-Man is actually one of my favorite MCU movies.
Really?
It was one of those that I wasn't too sure about, and kind of not being familiar with the characters, like a guy that shrinks and runs with ants. Like, I wasn't sure how well this was going to work on the big screen, but I really loved it. Like, it really blew me away. I remember when it came back in 2015, I actually was way more enthusiastic about Ant-Man than Age of Ultron, which kind of blew my mind. Was definitely not expecting that. So it's been a favorite of mine. I think Paul Rudd is just fantastic in the role. Really love having him in the MCU. So I was really excited for this one. And I think it turned out it did turn out to be a case of kind of falling victim to expectations a little bit. It's a really fun movie, a great time at the theater, but kind of like you'd said, it's not fresh. It's not a surprise this time. So kind of knew to expect the jokes, kind of the story beat. So I didn't think it was quite as good as the first one, but I'm kind of curious to hear what others thought as well. Like I said, I still enjoyed it, but it didn't feel quite as good as the first one to me. And that could be simply a case of it's not a surprise this time.
Interesting. I did think that something, I mean, I enjoyed it overall. I think they did some things better and upped the game in this one. And I think they might have fallen short on a few things. But yeah,
yes.
I'd be really curious to talk about what worked for everybody. Alex, what about you? Overall, what were your feelings about it?
Again, you know, going in with a Thanos-sized crowd, which is to say about half full.
that was very nice.
Was there? We just move on. You know, going into the film, I expected a lighthearted superhero comedy. Yeah, we were going to get some action. Yeah, we were going to get some fighting, but I was going in for Paul Rudd's character, for Michael Cera's character, Luis. I was going in for the banter style that we get. And honestly, as far as for humor and back and forth, the Ant-Man movies, I think, trump all the others as far as dialogue goes.
Really?
There's one scene I would say maybe not on, and that's when in Civil War, in which Winter Soldier asks if Falcon can move the seat up. And Falcon says no. So he just slides over a little bit. That dynamic was just so perfect that I think as far as comedy goes, that's it. But the back and forth banter, the Michael Cera's speed talking is genius. And I have to wonder how much of that is actually written and how much of it is him just going, I get to narrate something in a superhero movie. And I love that. Honestly, in this one, what made me enjoy the film was the B characters, the B level characters, those secondary characters in the film.
Yeah. What about you, Mike?
Oh, in a lot of ways, I'm agreeing with what you guys are saying. For me, actually, my favorite character in that movie was Cassie in a lot of ways.
She was great.
She was awesome. I loved her in the first movie, but she stole a lot of the scenes in this one.
I'll tell you what, that sequence between her and Paul Rudd in the attic, and she wants to be his partner. And it's just that one brought tears to my eyes. It really did. I thought that was so well done between the two of them. They have such chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just like that scene where, you know, he was like going, you know, saying, I think I might need a partner. I would be your partner. And then he turns and say, what kind of father would I be if I did that?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just,
which
awesome.
Showed he had grown a lot since the last film or even since, you know, the Avengers. That was one of the neat things I liked about this, between the way they handled his character after Civil War. People were angry at him for what he did because he didn't ask them first. He just got the call and went, which was something very similar in a way, I think, to his to the first movie, and what got him arrested and put in jail to begin with was that he didn't talk to people first. He just did it.
Yep.
And towards the end of the movie, he goes from being reactionary to thinking more about what needs to be done and done right. So I think we do get a growth there. Cassie, my sister put it best on Cassie. She had to see it several times because she has multiple children that couldn't get together all at once. Also, my sister's a nerd and doesn't want to admit it and likes to go to the movies a bunch. But she put it best. She said that Cassie walked a very, very thin line between being absolutely adorable and being completely over the top irritating. And she never slipped into the irritating portion.
No, not at all. I agree.
Right. When I say it the way I said it, I mean that as a compliment. She never slipped. She never got to a point where you're just rolling your eyes and going, here's the cute kid trope.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But then on the other side of that, I also found not the ex-wife, but the stepfather.
Yeah.
He was a great character in the first movie. You know, mm-hmm. He was playing the bad cop, you know, trying to, you know, be there for Cassie and everything, but, you know, being a hard ass on Scott. But in this, he was like, all right, group hug, you're doing great. It was like, it almost felt like, oh, they just threw the character back in there because they had to.
That is one of the big complaints that I have for this film, is that a lot of the characters have that we just threw them into the film because they had to be there. And unfortunately for me, Lawrence Fishburne's character felt that way. Michael Douglas's character felt like that for me. And the Wasp character felt that way for me, which really? Is a big problem. Yeah, I did not feel that her character – I don't feel that her character was afforded an arc, a better story, a solid story for her. I don't know if it was a case where they were filming the movie and trying to figure out how to work it with all the stuff that was going on with the other Marvel movies and just said, well, we're going to do this for now. And then when we come back, we can fix this. And instead what we had was a case of good actors, good characters, and nothing for them.
See, for me,
I don't want to say nothing, but I will go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
No. I've disagreed with you on that one, Alex. I thought basically Michael Douglas was Reed Richards in this one. I felt like I was easily watching someone if could have been a Fantastic Four movie, a good Fantastic Four movie. I thought his lab was Reed Richards' lab completely.
And that's great, but he's supposed to be Hank Pym.
I know.
Right.
But Hank Pym was a very similar character in the early days in the comics. He was a scientist who did that type of thing. And instead of ants, he would have just had a thing there instead. And I loved how they used the ants as the workers in the lab. And I just thought it was great. And Lawrence Fishburne's character was a total geek out moment for me. He was Black Goliath, you know, mm-hmm. from the comics. And
yeah, it's just Goliath now.
I know, it's now just Goliath. You had to be politically correct. I worked on that Goliath
like Arrow,
project.
You know, and it's not just a black thing, you know, Arrow. It's not Green Arrow anymore. It's just Arrow. Like, they just, you know, take colors out. I know, we're all colorblind now.
But they just don't call him Panther.
Still Black Lightning.
Still Black Lightning.
Still Black Lightning. Still Black Panther.
Still Black Panther. Exactly. But I thought it was cool. And I liked the little twist they did with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was really well done in a lot of ways. And you know what? I didn't mind those characters. There were other characters I could have done without, but, you know, they wanted to add the humor in it and add, you know, the other workers in the office and such. But, you know, they had their comeuppance too. So it was pretty cool.
Here's what I like. I like the fact that, you know, they sort of flipped the script a little bit, because traditionally you have in your action roles, you have your action hero who's doesn't really get a lot of scenes emotionally. He just does all the action sequences.
Mm-hmm.
And the female character is the one that gets the emotional resonance with folks. Right. This movie seems to like swap those roles. And I think to great effect. But unfortunately, I find that a little bit of what you're talking about, whereas Evangeline Lilly is great and she has some tremendous action sequences. She is like a legitimate threat, like an A-list threat. Like, yes, she should have been on Cap's team, right?
Right.
But she doesn't get a lot of the emotional scenes that Paul Rudd does. And I think Paul does one of his, I think it's one of the best Paul Rudd movies I've ever seen. Like, he is so good in this. Because yes, we know that he can handle the humor. He's got great comedic timing. He knows how to like underplay, or he knows exactly how to play a line, whether to overplay it, underplay it, no matter what. Like, he's there. But what I'm really surprised by is the like emotional resonance he has with scenes like his daughter and with there's legitimate like concern and regret and indecision. Like you said, like exactly what you said, Alex. I mean, he gets that moment where he does go, like he has a history of going off and doing things his own, and he wants to do that again. So when that's why that scene with Cassie is so pivotal. Because he wants to do it again, but he's like, no, I have to be responsible. I have to stay with you. And she gives him permission to do it again. And so he goes out and saves his friends. Well, needs to be saved as well. So it's really great. But I do find that, yes, some of the other characters don't get enough play. While it was cool to see Michael Pena back and he gets some good lines, the other two guys might as well not have been there. They really didn't add much at all. And I think the Cassie's family doesn't really add much at all. I did like Lawrence Fishburne's character. I thought it was great. But I'm curious to what you guys thought. Now, I think in the first one, we kind of all maybe kind of hemmed and hawed. And once again, it was kind of a boring villain for Ant-Man, right? It's just a typical Marvel bad guy, not really well developed, just goes and does bad guy things. This is a different kind of bad guy. What did you guys think of Ghost?
I thought she was awesome.
I did as well. It was really interesting to have a villain who wasn't necessarily a villain. She had her own goals and she was working towards those and maybe made some compromises that the heroes wouldn't. But I just really loved how they revealed the reason why she was doing what she was doing. And that even though she was going about it probably in the wrong way by trying to literally suck the life out of Janet, she wasn't doing it to be bad or to take over the world. She was this person who was in constant pain. And I thought the actress did a good job. Just some of these grimaces and just facial expressions, like you could tell every moment was agony for her. So I thought she was a really interesting character. I almost kind of wish they had dialed back on the other kind of secondary villain, the black market dealer, and given even more time to Ghost and Lawrence Fishburne's character, because I thought that was a really interesting dynamic and I would have liked to see even more from them than we got to.
Do you really consider Ghost a bad guy in this though?
Yes.
She was an antagonist.
Yeah, if it hadn't been for, Foster's character, like, she would have done really horrible things. Yeah. Like, and at the end, she does. She goes for broke, and she is. We can sympathize with what she's doing, much in the same way as,
Michael Keaton's Vulture.
Right, or exactly.
Yeah.
These are well-developed, deep. I think Marvel is trying to address the fact that, they want to make their villains as interesting as some of their heroes. And I think they did a pretty good job. I was not familiar with Ghost and I don't think this is a great interpretation of her as far as that being that faithful to, I think, because isn't Ghost an Iron Man villain?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and also she was a he in the comics.
Yeah. That's what I thought. So, but I love the outfit. I love the costume. So I thought, and I thought she was great. I don't think I'd seen her in anything before. She kind of looked a little familiar, but Hannah John Kamen, I think, is her name. So
she was in Ready Player One, actually.
Really?
Yeah, she was Fennel Zandor.
Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, very awesome. I love me some Walton Goggins. I do believe that he's kind of a one-note character here, so that's unfortunate. I really didn't like what they did with, I didn't mind that the FBI agent that was overseeing Scott was a boob, but calling him Jimmy Woo was kind of insulting to me because I like Johnny Woo from the comics, Agents of Atlas and all that. He's a very, very, very capable, more than capable FBI agent. And they kind of turned him into a boob. And I didn't really appreciate that. I don't give major marks off for that, but I just find it just slightly annoying. And I really liked, you know, this is we didn't see Janet in the first one. So this is Michelle Pfeiffer as Janet Van Dyne. And I thought she was great. I do get, yes, Mike, especially in the Quantum Realm when they're reunited, you do get a Reed and Sue vibe from those two.
Oh, that was the negative zone right there.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know,
can I just ask something about Janet Van Dyne? 30 years in the Quantum thing. She still does makeup, still does her hair.
Sure. You got to look good, especially when your husband's coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she has the powers to be able to just add it, go like that.
No. I will say this. You guys have hit some great points and everything like that. I'm actually going to flip the script. I actually really enjoyed the side character, Luis's coworkers. I felt that they added to the scenes that he was in sort of a way of just going, yeah, this is him. You've asked the question, now deal with the answer. And Marvel is absolutely missing out if they do not release a t-shirt that says if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's probably True Serum. I actually really enjoyed Walton Goggins as Sonny Birch.
Well, Walton Goggins doesn't put in a bad performance. I just wish that he had been more interesting as a character.
I actually enjoyed him as a character. He was unlike the character of Ghost, who, you know, yes, we have a sympathetic side for her. We understand, and we understand why Lawrence Fishburne did what he did.
Yes,
to try to help her. Sonny Birch is evil.
Yeah,
Sonny Birch is just straight up evil. His card, his business card, says "bad guy." All right, it's one of those characters where sometimes you need a villain to just be a villain. And he added on to this. And yeah, we had an overabundance of characters. And that probably is why we didn't get a lot of development for a lot of these characters.
Yeah.
But I definitely think that the stuff we got of Sonny Birch and again, honestly, if there was ever a reason to bring back the Marvel one shots on the Blu-rays, I want a Luis storyline. I want something where he is telling the story of anything.
I want him before Infinity War 2 or whatever they end up calling the next Avengers movie. I want him to be responsible for the previously on.
Yes.
That would be fantastic.
I want him sitting there and seriously, in like 10 minutes of just a nonstop ramble, have him give you the entire Infinity War movie.
The entire decade of the last MCU.
So first superhero, right? And then he got frozen. And then...
just like my cousin. So, all right. So a big high for me. We talked about the characters and a big high for me. I think the biggest achievement of this, where this movie really excels. We talked a couple weeks ago about Incredibles 2 and how even though with these live action movies, I was amazed and impressed that Incredibles 2 can give us action sequences, superpowered beings with superpowered beings that we've never seen before, that look so fluid and so amazing. Well, boom, not 2 weeks later, we get this, and the fight sequences with Wasp in particular, and the chase sequences, the car chase. How many times have we seen a car chase, right? We've never seen a car chase like this. Like, it is just phenomenal, the effects, how they use the shrinking and enlarging, and it's just so well choreographed, so well done. I think they're achievements in and of themselves.
It makes me more respectable for Matchbox cars, literally.
Yeah, I really liked the finale. That was my favorite part of the movie, actually, because even like you said, we've seen car chases so many times, but I love that they kind of took that trope it did something totally fun. Like, I love seeing the car suddenly shrink down to a tiny size and then get increase. And I thought that was a really fun way to handle something we've seen in film a lot. So, and again, with the fight sequences like that too, we've seen villains punch each other, but we haven't seen ghosts like phasing in and out of dimensions and then waft shrinking down. So I really like, I think that's one of the things this film does really well, is taking some of these well-known action tropes, but doing them in a cool way, because you have the power to shrink and then grow big. And I really loved Giant Man's reappearance at the end of the movie too. So just a lot of fun little things like that, that they're able to do with the technology that makes this particular superhero thing unique.
Yeah. I definitely want to see a behind the scenes vignette on the making of the Wasp ghost fight scene.
Yeah.
Cause there are moments where Wasp is really, really tiny and can't be hit. And there's times where she's really, really big, but can't punch Ghost. And I'm like, how? How do you do this? Practical effects will not let this happen. How are you doing this? And I think that is one of the better fight scenes. I'm not sure that I'd put it at the level that Incredibles 2 had with the fight between Void and Violet.
Right.
But I definitely see where you're going. And it was definitely a different style. I'd like to know what Hank Pym was doing with a purple souped up hot rod with flames on it as one of the choices. Because at some point Hank Pym went, yeah, no. So I don't know. But that was really fun. And again, that was the kind of car that absolutely Luis would be driving in that kind of scenes, because that's the kind of character they've made him. But yeah, I like the fight scenes. I'll say this. I love the interaction with the car chase scene, with the bouncing up and down and shrinking and whatnot. And I love the fact that we went, like, we were big size and they were small, that the car sounded like it was a wind up.
Yep.
So it sounded like a Prius.
Exactly.
But I will say this. I kind of feel like they did one trick in the movie twice. And the second time it didn't work for me as well. The scene in which they're in the kitchen and she enlarges the salt shaker.
Yep.
Great moment, because you don't see it coming. Except if you've seen any one of the trailers.
Right.
The Pez, I feel, was not as impressive.
Also in the trailer.
But as much as her shrinking the motorcycle.
Yes.
Which I thought was great, because there was a dude on it and then it was gone.
Yeah, I agree. The Pez, I think, was sold by Luis. Like that, like Luis sold me on the Pez thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I thought that worked as well. But speaking of which, speaking of the trailer, there's like three or four lines, like, in the trailer that are not in this movie.
Nowhere close.
Yeah. That you think that are going to be, like, really funny lines. And they're not in this movie at all, which I thought was very interesting. Like, I dare say that I missed them, because I just was so used to them in the trailers. And they seemed like they were good lines. I'm just surprised that they were cut.
Well, and if you take a look at the trailer again, I believe the last full trailer, we get a shot of the last scene in the movie. In there, because we see the ant playing the drums.
Right.
Yes
we do. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you wait all that time
for that. Just
this little quick thing,
yeah,
and that you've already seen in the trailer. Right. I did. Two people I know have told me that it is the worst Marvel end credit scene that they've ever seen.
That's close.
I didn't think it was that bad, so I'm not going to put it at that level.
No, not.
I mean,
at
maybe
all.
If I had to rank them, it would be on the bottom, but that's not a far drop.
Here's the thing on that is that it's not so much that it's the worst one, it's the least useful. And the fact is if we'd gone with just the mid scene, imagine having the mid scene credit. You get that. You go all the way through the end of end of the credits, waiting for the second mid secret scene, and instead we just see Ant-Man and Wasp will return?
Mm-hmm. That would have been much better.
Much better. Yeah. There's nothing to the gravitas of that scene. I mean, even with the homecoming, where Captain America comes out and talks about patience, it's epic Marvel trolling. It's just Marvel sitting there saying, "You waited for this. Behold, nothing." With this one, after the heaviness of the mid-credits sequence.
Yeah, to lose all three.
Yeah, this was mm-hmm. the one that was...
The only thing that would have tore our heart out more if it had been Cassie.
Oh, yeah, I was afraid of that. It's like, I don't yeah. know
I'd like to point out that Cassie was not in the house. We don't know.
Well, yeah, but that was Scott's place. It wasn't with her mom.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, but we have to assume the aunt was babysitting.
Why do we have to?
I don't know. I don't know. No, hopefully no. Hopefully that.
But
hopefully
it was. It was interesting to see though the devastation, because this is the mm-hmm. first time you see like a city after Thanos snapped his fingers and such.
Right.
Because literally,
well, you see the scene with at the end of Infinity War. You do see New York.
Yes, but you get to see San Francisco, and you see that the TV stations are off the air.
Right.
And yeah. You know, everything is pretty much in disarray, even and more
it's
so.
Silent.
Yeah.
And the answer in and control.
It's silent. And the answer in control.
Which they kind of hinted at in the movies.
Yeah.
When they were at the drive-in.
If exactly. plant, yeah, the ant, and drive-in scene. Sequence was really nice. And it shows that Cassie got to shrink too. So.
All right, so I'll throw this out there, and then we'll wrap it up. But so a lot of people were hoping, expecting, theorizing that Ant-Man would have something to do with the next Avengers movie. Do you think that's true, or do you think, or do you want it to be true, or do you think this is just sort of it, and that we you know, they're going to be off doing their own separate adventures, maybe?
I think that it will play a big role, and I really want it to play a big role. Like, I think the fact that he is trapped in the quantum realm is not a coincidence, and especially with all the stuff going on with the Infinity Stones, I really hope that they take this opportunity to do something really interesting with him stuck in there. Like, absolutely terrifying, the idea of being trapped in the quantum realm, there's no way to get out. So I hope that they're really able to play in with that, because I was kind of disappointed that Ant-Man didn't only got name dropped in Infinity War. So I think it would be really cool if he is some part of the solution of whatever happens in Avengers 4. I don't know how it will play out. I don't want to know how it will play out, but I'm looking forward to being surprised.
I agree with Ashley. I definitely think it'll play out into Infinity War 2, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I definitely think Ant-Man, because especially when Janet said there were little time portals that, they kind of were laying the groundwork for it right there.
And yeah. I am wondering if maybe we might actually see another introduction of another Marvel villain in the form of Kang the Conqueror, who is also a little bit of known for both time portals and the quantum realm.
Hmm. Very possible.
It's certainly a possibility, and it could be a way to get him out. It could also be a way of getting all of these people back.
Well, and if one of the theories is that everybody who has gone mm-hmm. is in the we're going to see them, you know, try to mount some sort of escape, and definitely having the brain power of the Van Dynes would be, you know, something.
Yeah.
To that would be a good thing. And you've got like a kick-ass woman to help you with the action sequences there too.
Well, plus you've got Rudd, who you got the Ant-Man character. Who? Why did he go into the quantum realm to get the healing energy? There yep. could be something to that mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that, if we were to speculate, we could go on wild tangents about what it is. My personal theory is that everybody who's vanished is now in the quantum realm, and Michelle Pfeiffer's like, "Damn it."
Yeah, I just got out of here.
See, that's what I want. I want them to vanish, appear in the quantum realm, have her look around and go, "Son of a," and then it closes. And then that would have been the second scene for me. That would have been the second scene for me.
That's funny. All right, so let's grade it and then get out of here. Ashley, we read your wonderful review, but where do you stand on it as far as a grade?
You know, I'm going to give it a very solid 4. This was really entertaining for me. I was really looking forward to it. I loved Infinity War, but it's nice to have something that's a little bit lighter and more fun. And again, I just love Paul Rudd in this role. I think he's a great addition to the MCU, really great as the character. And like we mentioned, the scenes with him and Cassie were nice and some cool action sequences. So a very enjoyable time at the theater. Would definitely encourage people to go see it if they haven't already. And just another fun entry in the MCU.
Alex?
The movie itself gets a solid 4 stars. It then loses a star for that mid-credit sequence. Do not get me emotionally invested in these characters and then kill them again. I am not happy with that, and Marvel uses that trope way too often. I've
get
talked
used
about
to it
before. I know, but I'm, and every time they do it, I'm gonna say it until somebody points out that, you know, they're making billions of dollars, and I'm an hourly wager. So, I'm giving it 3 stars. I really felt that for shock value, the mid-credit sequence was amazing. But the end credit one was not necessary. So for me, overall, it's a 3-star movie.
Mike?
Well, I'm going to go the opposite way. I'm actually going to give this a 4.5.
Ooh.
I thought it was a perfect popcorn movie. I think it fits perfectly after the first Ant-Man. And I think it flowed really neat. And it was fun watching. Wait a minute, that's Atlanta. Wait, no, that's San Francisco. That's Atlanta. Yes. That's San Francisco. So
I mean, can you imagine having to adjust your watch every time? It's no wonder they've got time tunnels.
Exactly. See? So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought the characterizations were great. I thought the humor was pretty awesome. And I like that he was having fun with the size control and everything and how the suit was malfunctioning. I loved when he was in the elementary school and had to wear the, you know, the hoodie and everything. And then when he went out to the van, and he said, "Hey, sport, how was your day?"
And I totally forgot about that.
It's like, I loved it. And Michael Douglas
box
saying,
and string. You want the juice box and string? He's like, "Do you really have that?
Do you have that?
Yeah.
Really?" That was just awesome. And it was a lot of fun. And that's what I needed right now. I was tired from my vacation. And so it was the perfect time. And to watch it, and you know, it is what I needed. I didn't need anything. God, if I would have had, you know, something like Infinity War, I probably would be jumping off a building or something right now.
Yeah.
Over the last 10 years, Marvel has been doing everything right and succeeding. And they're not, I mean, just because they're, you know, over the hump with the Infinity War doesn't mean that they're stopping, because this is just as consistent as anything else they've done. Mm-hmm. It's just so solid. It's like we said before, it's an easy get. Like, you're just like, okay, it's a Marvel movie, I'm in, you know, because it's like, there's no question to me. I give it a 4, a solid 4 though. I think I probably gave the first one about a 4. So, I think this is right there. Like I said, they do something so well. It peaks really well. Some things, like characters, get a little bit of the short straw, and that's unfortunate, but it really is, it's not really a character piece, you know? It really is kind of a situational comedy, if you will, not quite a farce, but it's all set up, right? And it's all got these very great action sequences and comedic moments. And I think it does, you know, definitely sow the seed for what's to come, which is really nice. So now we have to wait, what, a few months for Ms. Marvel, Captain Marvel?
You have to wait till March, my friend.
March?
Yeah.
Really? I thought, for some reason, I thought it was the fall.
Nope. The only superhero movie coming out in the fall is Aquaman, but that's at another company.
Yeah, it's going to be completely different. So, well, cool. Well, thanks, everybody, once again. And we'll be back with the ESO Network Con Report.
Did you know the ESO Network has a brand new Patreon? That's right. We're asking for your help, and you could do it for as little as $1 a month. Don't fret. All your favorite shows will still be available for free as always, but now you can get exclusive podcasts and more not heard anywhere else but on our Patreon. To sign up for the ESO Network, Patreon's easy. All you have to do is click on the link on the top navigation of the ESO Network website or go to patreon.com/ESO Network. With your support of the ESO Network, it's you who will reap the rewards. Hey everyone, welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Network Con Report.
Well, before we start talking about future events where you can find ESO Network folks, we have with us, of course, Alex is still hanging around, and we're going to talk to him all about, you had the pleasure of going to Fan Expo a couple weeks ago. So let's hear your report, man. How was it?
You know, Fanboy Expo in Knoxville, Tennessee was honestly one of the best times I've had at a convention, and I'm now beginning to wonder if I am going to be a small con connoisseur. This was a fairly nice sized convention with a lot of great, great celebrities. Mm-hmm. There was a couple of things I think we're missing, and we'll discuss that in a moment. But it really took place for the most part in one room, aside from their panels. Discussion. It really took place in the Congress, in the convention center, the Knoxville Convention Center's main room. And you had all your celebrities there. You had your dealer's room, your artist gallery, all of that was there. And they had some really great folks there that were not listed as being there, which was kind of a nice surprise. When we had David on, one of the things that we mentioned was the fact that it was going to be a very wrestling heavy show.
Mm-hmm.
And we were actually pleasantly surprised to see not only some legends from the Mid-South area, including White Lightning, Tim Horner, and Dr. Tom Pritchard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which threw a lot of us off. We were not prepared for that. But he made his name in the Alabama, Tennessee area before he got moved up to the Connecticut with the WWF. But one of the vendors brought in Shane Douglas and Francine from ECW. Unannounced.
Wow.
So there they were signing autographs and everything. Right across from people like Tom Berenger, Corbin Burnson, William Zabka, the Four Horsemen, Ricky Steamboat, all of them in a line, bam, right across from them, Shane Douglas and Francine.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. I will say this about this con. I don't know, and we had talked with David about how long he'd been doing this, and I'm not sure how long Fanboy Expo has been taking place in Knoxville, but I truly believe that this year was a growth year for them. They had a couple of issues that, in all honesty, could have wrecked the entire convention. Number one, the weather out of New York was so abysmal Thursday and Friday that flights were being canceled, so celebrities were not getting there.
Ooh, yeah, that's a hard one.
They handled that. One of the biggest ones that was going to be there was three of the members of the Backstreet Boys. Two of them stuck in New York with canceled flight after canceled flight after canceled flight. To make up for it, what they did was they contacted everybody who was on their list who might have just been a Friday or a Saturday, Sunday only, and said, "We need you. Can you get here?" Friday at this convention, you could have walked up to Ian McDermott and gotten his autograph without standing in line.
Wow.
I got 15 autographs at this event. 14 of them I got on Friday.
It's always nice to get all that out of the way in the first day.
Knocked all of that out. Ric Flair had a VIP only line as well as his regular line. A lot of the big names had a VIP line along with their regular line, and they took care of a lot of that. But the fact that they kept making announcements in the main room as to what panels were about to start, as well as keeping everybody up to date on who was arriving, was exceptional, because it was a full transparency con. When there were problems, they said, we have problems and we're working to fix it.
That's, you know what, communication is the key. We know that there's going to be problems every once in a while, sure. No matter what con you go to. It's the keeping people in the dark, trying to sweep things under the rug. That's where you burn bridges. Yep. That's where a lot of cons fail miserably and end up, you know, being like that's their last show.
Yeah.
And yeah, that can break a con. Real quick, just on the tangent here. I know that I understand that Ric Flair's recently had surgery. And how did he look? Is he in good spirits?
Flair was in great spirits. And that's one thing I want to talk about this con. Everybody who was there, every last one of the guests was in phenomenal spirits. They were happy to be there. They were happy to do whatever. Every table pretty much had a, it's this much for an autograph, it's this much for a photo. And I can't tell you the number of celebrities who sat there and said, let's get a photo together. You've got a camera, pick it up, take a photo.
Nice.
Let's just do that. And I have never seen that at another convention. No. William Zabka may be the greatest man ever. There was a child in front of me, 12 years old, and he told Zabka that he was just getting into acting himself. Zabka talked with him for 10 minutes, said, let's get a picture together, stood up there, and they got in the position to fight, like in a fighting stance. Zabka realized that his stance was all wrong, gave him a karate lesson. And I'm sitting there going, why am I not recording this?
Right.
There's William Zabka showing him how to hold his hands, how to get it set up, you know, make sure you've got plenty of tension so when it strikes, it hits hard. I'm just watching this. And I'm going, well, there you go. And then 5 minutes later, walked up to Bill Farmer, and Bill Farmer said to me as Goofy, hiya, pal. I could have gone home at that moment. Nice. And it would have been a perfect convention.
So great celebrity signing. Obviously they were keeping, if the celebrities were, you know, having fun, that means that, you know, the show's making them happy. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah, they're being taken care of. It was very, very strange staying in the hotel, 'cause I've never done that before.
Uh-huh.
And all the celebrities stayed in the same hotel.
So you're having encounters in the elevators.
Riding the elevator at one point with Bill Farmer, at two points with Jason Marsden, who was the voice of Max from A Goofy Movie, who informed me that if I just asked for his autograph in the elevator, I wouldn't have had to pay $20. I'm just like, that's not how you make money. And I thought maybe you were Daniel Logan. You know, there were those sorts of moments. We had an issue where the wrong pizza was delivered to us, and I had to bring it back downstairs, get on the elevator. James J. Dillon, WWE Hall of Fame manager, gets on the elevator with me, looks at me and goes, I don't even know what that is, but it smells good. And you can't freak out. You can't freak out. You have to go, yeah, you know, they screwed up my order. You know, no, in my head, I'm like, this is one of the greatest managers of all time. And he's asking me, do I give him the pizza that's not mine? You know, but the other issue they had, and I say this was a growth year for them. Apparently this is the largest crowd they'd had.
Right.
And because of that, the convention center's air conditioning was not strong enough. So the main room got hot quick.
That can lead to some con funk.
That can lead to not only some con funk, it can lead to some irritation and everything. And I think there's a couple of things that were missing from the con that if they had those, might not have been a problem. They had one room where they were doing all the panels. So literally it was a case of one panel at a time.
Right.
There was no – they had the entire convention center, and the place is huge. At no point in time did they have a room that was showing movies or videos or anything. And again, it's one of those weird moments where I get to name drop a little bit. I actually walked in on the last day with Tiamat from The Last Dragon.
Wow.
Bruce Leroy.
Bruce Leroy.
Walking into the con together. And he was like, he was the one that mentioned it. And I hadn't even thought about it. He was like, yeah, it's kind of a drag. You know, we had the guy from The Karate Kid here and we had me here. And there was no showings of The Last Dragon or Karate Kid.
Right.
And I'm like, wow. Yeah, that should have happened. So I think that should happen. There was also the entire event was done over, you know, a great 3-day weekend, a lot of fun. And they had a concert on Saturday night. It was their after party with a band called the Gigawatts. And that's great. It's a great name. And they did nothing but standards. And I'm like, with a name like that, you should be doing as much geek related music as possible. No filking, no areas for other musicians. And I think both of those would have really elevated this con even more.
Wow. Yeah, that's true. That sounds like good suggestions. On an otherwise, because it looks like, you know, from what you're telling me, and I saw your pictures all weekend. So
yeah.
You were having a blast.
I was having a great time. And my buddy Todd, who is a terrific guy and the best co-pilot you could possibly have at one of these things, because he did not get any autographs on the first day. He got Ric Flair's and that was it. And that's because I bought it for him as a birthday present. But he was sitting there while I was standing in line, was scoping out the other lines. So like I would get out of a line and he would go, okay, Tully Blanchard just arrived. Go.
That's always cool to have like a lookout.
Yeah. And that's what he was doing. He was scouting around. You know, when I was standing in a longer line, he was shopping, but I would come out of a line and he would go, yeah, Whitmire's got two people in it. You could probably get your Kermit the Frog sign. So those sorts of moves. But one of the coolest things is we're driving back Sunday and there's this moment of pause where we're just kind of driving and he goes, you know, I could see myself going back to that con. And I'm like, okay, this is a guy who bought nothing for himself. The only thing he did was he went to the panel for Timothy Zahn and we got his photo taken with Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice man, considering all the uproar I had to go through him for Celebration. Very, very nice man, very cordial. But those were the only two things. And for him to sit there and say, I had so much fun at this, I want to come back, speaks volumes about this event.
Yes, and absolutely. And that's, great place to leave it. I really appreciate the report. And I'm glad ultimately that you had a great time.
Well, it's because of my VIP stature.
Oh, of course. Yes, of course. That makes all the difference, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we'll see what we see. Well, it's good that you gave a good review because maybe you can get one again next
week. Maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, thank you so much, Alex. I'm glad you had a good time.
A pleasure.
And so I do want to give a quick shout out before I start with some other dates that are going to be starting this weekend. I got to give a shout out to Richard Morgan of Richard Comics and Games in Greenville, North Carolina. He had an event that celebrate independent comics. Myself, Bobby Nash and Peter Cutler were there and had a great time, met some great folks. And it was just a great way to spend a Saturday afternoon just in a comic shop hanging out with folks. So thank you, Richard, for the invitation. If you're in Greenville, check out Richard Comics and Games. It's a great store. I also want to point out that this week, July 12th, the Seekers of the Lost World premiere in Tampa, Florida. It's on the big screen. I do understand that tickets are officially sold out. So congratulations to everybody who got tickets. I hope you enjoy the show. If for some reason you desperately need a ticket, contact Jason Arita. They may have some folks who can't make it. They did say that there may be a chance that they might be able to squeeze you in somehow. So if you are really wanting to catch this premiere of this landmark event in Tampa, Florida, check that out. Again, it's July 12th. Please reach out to Jason Arena as soon as you can. And then this weekend, Mike and I and Alex will be at the Atlanta Comic Con. That is at the Georgia Will Congress Center. We will be walking around. None of us have tables. I understand that Alex will be there on Saturday. Is that correct?
I will be there Saturday. I'm going to try to be there starting early in the morning. Look for me. I'll be the large man in the geeky t-shirt.
Awesome. Yeah, we shouldn't be hard to find at all. and then Mike and I will be there both Saturday and Sunday. We actually are doing panels. And Mike, I understand our panels are at noon. Is that correct? Or at one? Is that right?
Yes, sir. On Sunday, we are doing a panel at noon talking all about Doctor Who.
Awesome. Yes. I thought we were doing on Saturday too. No.
Saturday, we're doing a podcasting panel.
Right. So that one is on Saturday. What time?
I think right now that's 1 p.m.
Okay. So 1 p.m. on Saturday.
But okay. Look at the schedule just yes. in case.
Please do. Yeah. I think we're still waiting to get final word, even though it's in a few days, but you know how that works. It's a convention. So, otherwise Mike and I will be walking around. I've already got some celebrities that, I am planning to, I was going to say stalk, but that sounds so bad. So I'm just going to say,
we don't need another restraining order.
No, we really don't. All right. So that's where we'll be this weekend. Come find us and say howdy. And then also this weekend is Congregate. That is in High Point, North Carolina. Angela Pritchett, the geek girl herself, will be at that show. She will also be at the Potterverse convention in Rockville, Maryland, which I think may be renamed soon. I hear there's a little bit of controversy with the name of that convention. And that is August 17th through the 19th. And so check that out while it's still named Potterverse. And then the big daddy of them all in August, August 31st through September 3rd. It's just a mere 2 months away. It is Dragon Con. And as I said at the top of the hour, the show must go on. And we are looking forward to a big, big, big convention this year, bigger and better. Of course, myself and Mike will be there. Ashley, who you've just heard with her review of Ant-Man and Wasp. She will be in attendance. It's her first ever Dragon Con. Also from Earth Station Who, Mary Ogle will be there. From the Plopcast, Kevin Eldridge will be there. Angela Pritchett, the Geek Girl, will be there. Jason and Rita, fresh off their world premiere of their movie, Seekers of the Lost World, they will be in attendance. The Nerd Bliss crew of Chris, Tina, Eric, and Dan will be there. Thomas from the Geeky Geekly Oddcast. Woo, that is a tongue twister. Thomas from the Geekly Oddcast will be there. And of course, Joe and Brad from the Cigar Nerds will be there. There's going to be more to come. We're still getting reports from other ESO network shows. So watch this space. And if you've got a convention that you want to shout out about, whether it's something like Fan Expo or just a little show that you really, really, really want to get the word about, you want us to help promote, please reach out to us because we love talking about conventions.
Update, update, update from the Atlanta Comic Con, actually. Sorry to throw this in at last minute, Mr. Mike.
That's all right. That's how cons work.
That is. We are doing 11:30 in the morning on Saturday for the podcast panel. And then on Sunday at 2:30 p.m. through 3:30 p.m., we're doing Doctor Who, out with the old, in with the new. So find out for rooms, go to the con website, and, you know, this probably is still going to change. So, because yes. It's already changed on us. So there you go.
So as of right now, but look to the Facebook group, the ESO Network Facebook group, because we will post our set time, schedule times there. And if there's any changes, we will keep you posted there as well.
So that's going to wrap up another episode of the Earth Station One podcast. I want to thank everyone for joining us. Of course, at the beginning of the show, we had Mark Maddox, Bobby Nash, Alan O.W. Barnes, and, you know, talking all about Steve Ditko, who recently passed away at 90. So thank you guys for joining us for that. And, you know, if you haven't checked out Steve's work, please, please, please. There's so much that he created and so much that's out there. And you probably have read his work somewhere down the line. Mm-hmm. Well, the Marvel movies that we talk about on the show, a lot of it's based on his work. So, you know, definitely it's worth checking out, folks. Truly is. Let's thank our folks for the movie section of the podcast tonight. Ashley, thank you as always.
Oh, thank you. I always have a great time chatting movies with you guys.
Anything you want to shout out about?
Yes, just continuing to post reviews and stuff for movies throughout the summer. A lot of the big ones have come and gone, but it's not quite over yet. So looking forward to the Mission Impossible movie in a couple weeks, and we'll see how that turns out.
It's going to be interesting, at least to say.
And this weekend, Hotel Transylvania 3.
And Skyscraper.
Wow.
Sure.
Wow, the pregnant pause was wonderful. It's Die Hard, the building.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to remake Towering Inferno, come on. They could have done it better. So Die Hard meets Towering Inferno, basically. Alex, thank you so, so much.
Always a pleasure. Love getting to talk with you guys. It is, I especially on a film like this one where we had a little bit of disagreement because of the fact that we were able to, as fans, state what we liked, state what we didn't, and nobody got in a tizzy over it.
Oh, God, no. So, that's the thing we like to show on this podcast. Yeah. Everybody can get along without putting each other down. And I'm glad we disagreed on it. You know, it's Kumbaya is great sometimes, but
more entertaining, though.
Exactly. Yeah. It's more entertaining and it's a lot more fun when, you know, you go, Jane, you ignorant slut, you know, stuff like that. It's awesome. Yes, that's a Saturday Night Left reference, folks, you know, for you younger people out there. Ashley, you know.
I got that reference.
Nice. I can see Ashley just sitting there in her Captain America outfit. I got that reference.
I try to drop that line whenever I can.
Yeah.
I think she's going to be using that a lot at Dragon Con.
Yeah.
Anything you want to shout out about, Alex?
I just, you know, with all the sadness, we've had a lot of sadness go along this last week. I want to send a very special happy birthday. In 1981, we were given Donkey Kong on this date.
Wow. So
happy birthday, Donkey Kong.
Wow. Makes me want to go run out with a big hammer and start breaking barrels.
Yeah. But it beats going to see the movie Pixels again.
Touche. Touche. Mm-hmm.
Again?
Somebody had to see it once.
You were the one?
No.
Okay. Good, good, good. And of course, Mr. Mike.
As always, it's my pleasure.
What do you got for us this week?
Well, I know that we're talking about a lot of Marvel stuff with, you know, talking all things Ditko and with this MCU movie and everything. But over the weekend, I did spend some time talking over on the other side of the station in the DCU realm with the Earth Station DCU folks, both Cletus and Drew. And we talked about Drew, I think, for the first time had seen the Batman 66 movie on the big screen. So he wanted to talk about that. And of course, I'm all over talking about the Batman 60s show. But we also reviewed the latest issue of Batman that came out, Batman issue number 50, the quote-unquote wedding issue. And yes, I will use that in quotes. Also the follow-up Catwoman issue number 1 that had come out as well. So great fun talking all about that. If you want to hear my thoughts on those books, this week, you can tune in to Earth Station DCU.
DCU is always a fun place to stop by, and Cletus and our friends out there are doing a great, great job.
Well over 100 episodes. Yeah. They're just cranking them out every week.
Who thought when Drew came to us and said, hey, I want to do a DCU podcast, that they would make it this far? I didn't. Yeah. And I thought they'd go the way as the MCU podcast. Sigh. Okay. All right. My shout out real quick goes out to my lovely wife, Judy. And I'm very happy to say that on 4th of July, my wife and I renewed our vows in front of Elvis in Las Vegas.
Oh, congratulations. That's awesome.
Yes. We went to the Viva Las Vegas Chapel of Love in downtown Las Vegas. And we got married, renewed our vows, married, whatever you want to call it. By the king himself. And he came out and started singing It's Now or Never. It was awesome. And she married me for the third time. Pretty darn awesome. So, Judy, for putting up with me for all this time and being a glutton for punishment for both of us.
God bless her.
Exactly.
You know, re-upping the contract. That, you know, that's amazing.
It's pretty third awesome. Time
she's married you. What have you not? Have you screwed it up twice already?
No. The first time the government made us get married, but that's a whole other story.
Okay. Anything to keep you in the country, sir.
Exactly. You know, I'm that illegal, you know, alien from New Jersey.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty awesome there. But yeah, it was awesome. And then we went to see Beatles Love in Vegas. It was awesome. So Cirque du Soleil, awesome, man. They put on a great show once again. So, of course, we want to hear from you. Please write us at earthstation1@esonetwork.com or call us at 404-963-9057. So that's going to wrap up the show for this week. My name is Mike Faber, and we will see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace. And we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the T Public Store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.